Hello, everyone. This is Steve Baker, your friendly neighborhood pragmatic constitutionalist. I am back in D.C. after a weekend in my home of Raleigh, North Carolina. I want to just do a quick synopsis of day four, which was Friday, of the Oath Keepers trial, because I was not able to get to that on Friday, and I will explain why that is here in just a moment. And then I also want to kind of just give you my overall impressions of the first week of the trial. And normally, you know, I can walk and chew gum at the same time, which means I can cover multiple topics on any given day or week. But because of the seriousness and the intensity and the time required for me to do what I'm doing here in D.C., I'm really just, as I've explained to my readers, my followers over the last couple of weeks, that this is going to be my focus for as long as this trial remains. Not to say that we're not dropping some things on Twitter or Facebook or some of the other social media platforms on occasion. Our main home, of course, is our locals community, which is the pragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com. I hope that you will follow us there because that is the place where everything that we do originates, and that is also the place where you can support our efforts as well, should you choose to do that. It's free to subscribe at the pragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com, but for as little as $5 a month, you can support what we're doing, and I don't mind telling you, and I'm not ashamed to bring this up, it's incredibly expensive for me to be spending 6 to 8 weeks here in the District of Columbia and still yet maintain all my other expenses and bills back home because none of that goes away. So I am doing this because I consider this to be not just, it's not just the biggest trial in the country, and I'm living only four and a half hours away, so therefore I can be here. But I consider this to be a trial that has much further, far-reaching ramifications than just the guilt or innocence of these particular five defendants. Even though there's no cameras in the courtroom, and even though the MSM is painting the day's events and the results of each day in the trial and in the courtroom differently than some of us are seeing it, I think it's important for somebody to be in there and covering this. I unfortunately am not seeing in the media room every day. I'm not seeing Fox News. I'm not seeing Newsmax. I'm not seeing the Blaze TV. I'm not seeing the Daily Wire, the Daily Caller. I'm not seeing anybody else that would have the size of the bullhorn, I think, that is needed for this to be covered. So my small little voice is really the only one that's carrying, I really don't want to say an alternative opinion, because my goal is to present what's happening every day as factually and as accurately as it transpires, and not leave anything out like some of these other guys are doing, the big guys from the MSM are doing. I don't want to leave anything out. That doesn't mean at the end of my synopsis or at the end of my day, I'm not going to give you my opinion, because I can do both. Maybe that part of walking and chewing gum at the same time I can do. I think I can present accurately what has happened in the courtroom and at the same time interpret that in a way that I think that an entire different audience would want to hear than those who just listen to CNN and MSNBC. So there you go. Before we get started here, I do want to talk about this PayPal thing, because the PayPal thing directly affects me and many others like me. Unfortunately, PayPal and Stripe are two of the biggest payment processing systems that we are forced to use in this line of work. PayPal specifically, well, actually PayPal and Stripe I use for my other business, which is I am still in the music business, and I do work with bands, and I have a couple of my own bands. As a matter of fact, I was back in Raleigh this weekend because I had a show on Saturday. Yesterday, Sunday, I ran back up to D.C. to continue my coverage of the trial. But we do take, for my other business, we do take our payments from our clients on PayPal and through Stripe, both of those, depending upon the client's desire, which way they decide to make those payments. Unfortunately, we also use those platforms for the Pragmatic Constitutionalists as well, for our donations and our support on Locals. And Locals uses Stripe. I use, obviously, Stripe through Locals. And then, of course, I offer and make that available, PayPal available to our followers as well if they choose that route. They are the biggest. They are the best, unfortunately, at what they do. They're safe. They're secure. They give great accounting. They have great processing. They provide all the forms we need when it comes time to file taxes every year, all those kind of things. So it's just, it is what it is. And yes, the knee-jerk reaction is then to boycott PayPal, to cancel my account, that sort of thing. I just can't do it. I can't cancel it mainly because of my bans. I'm not dependent upon it for TPC. It's just another convenient avenue for our followers to choose when they do choose to donate or support us. So it will remain there. Obviously, PayPal, for those of you who haven't heard, they announced this absurd plan to actually fine, penalize, deduct at their discretion $2,500 from any of their account holders' accounts if said account holder offends them in any way through offering up on their social media accounts or in any other way, I would imagine, any kind type of misinformation. We know what misinformation is. It's an alternate opinion from the mainstream's approved narrative or from the government's approved narrative. We know that that's what it is. And to announce that they were going to fine for every occurrence $2,500, I just don't see how it would have stood legally. I know it could stand in Canada, maybe, as we saw with the truckers situation, but I just can't imagine that it would stand legally here in the United States, at least not yet. But nevertheless, that was their intention. The uproar was good enough, and this is one of those good news kind of things, that there was enough outrage expressed that they backed off and they reversed their decision, although they didn't really reverse their decision so much as they said that that was an error that was posted online. And guys, you know that when somebody says these types of things and these immediate reversals were an error, that's an absolute blatant lie, because nothing like that gets past their executive committees, their boardrooms, or their legal teams. All of those things for a company like that is run past very, very many eyeballs in their hierarchy, especially in their legal department, before they ever make it to their website or ever make it to their policies or ever make it to their community standards or anything like that. It just doesn't happen. And so obviously some very high level officials in the company did in fact see this. This was no mistake. They gave a directive to whoever took their approved wording, and it was posted and uploaded to their websites, and it went out as a new policies and procedures and terms of service, community standards, whatever you want to call it or whatever they call it. And then it was sent out to in an email for all of us to click on, or just a notification is all it was. Fortunately, some people saw that, caught it real quick, made it public. The outrage was intense, and PayPal backed off. I understand completely why many of you would have gone on ahead and canceled your PayPal accounts, because most people don't need them. Unfortunately, right now we do. And that is just the way of the world. And that's not to say that Stripe has not been a deplatformer either, because they also have. As a contributor and a content creator using the Locals community, Locals and Rumble uses Stripe for payment processing. So I have to trust the fact that they are in such a relationship, contractually and otherwise, to protect not only their brand, but all of us who are positioned in that community with an account directly with them, as TPC also is, myself. So going forward, I'm going to continue using both PayPal and Stripe for the time being, until there's, you know, better options, until we are presented with options that are available and safe and secure and integrate with our banks, because that's what it has to integrate with. It has to integrate with our banks. And so until that is done, we have no choice but to use those. And like YouTube, because I didn't have a large bullhorn, a very, you know, large presence on YouTube before we started, you know, actually after we just started on YouTube and doing podcasts, because I didn't do podcasts for the vast majority of the TPC's lifespan. That only began a couple of years ago. So never really had much time to build a following there before we moved to Rumble, before we joined Locals. And then there, of course, Locals and Rumble merged. So we just don't post to YouTube anymore, because Rumble is more than a capable, more than stable, more than adequate platform for what we're doing. So we do all of our videos on Rumble and Locals exclusively. And until there's such a replacement for PayPal and Stripe, we have to be there. So as I said, for now, I'm certain that we're secure and that you're secure in your payments using either PayPal or Stripe via Locals. We're simply just not a big enough target, really. Even if they put the hammer down right now, we're just not one of those big guys like, you know, Steven Crowder or Dave Rubin or somebody like that. So that we're not going to have to worry about that. The fact of the matter is that PayPal is who PayPal is, and they're going to retrench and figure out another way. For now, they just can't just go out there and steal our money. And they know that. There would be massive lawsuits against them very, very quickly. But they can still close our accounts. They can deplatform us, and they can do so without cause. That is in the community standards, and there's nothing that can stop them from doing that at any time. But as I said, I have no reason to fear that for the time being. All right, enough of that. So let's just jump into the recap of day 4 here at the District Courthouse in D.C. of the Oath Keepers trial. It was a short day. Apparently, every Friday is only a half day in the federal court system. And the first witness up for the prosecution that day was the United States Capitol Police Special Agent Ryan McCanley. Now, he's actually a liaison between the FBI and the Capitol Police. I think if I remember his story correctly, he began with the FBI and then moved to the Capitol Police, and he functions as the direct liaison between the two entities. He's very straight, buttoned up, G-man type guy, you know, just the facts, ma'am, yes sir, no sir kind of questions guy. Not much emotion from him at all, by contrast of the previous FBI special agent, Palian, who was the first prosecution's witness on the first couple of days, who was much more emotional and much more animated and much more antagonistic towards the defense questions than whereas Ryan McCanley, he was the same to both groups, which was not as entertaining, but much more of a pleasant experience. So he began, first of all, taking questions from Assistant U.S. Attorney Nessler about his activities doing covert surveillance on December 12th. And there was a rally in D.C. on December 12th, 2020. This was before January 6th, obviously, and before even there was an announcement about the January 6th rally on from President Trump or from the organizers. I think this rally was called the Million MAGA March. And this particular special agent was himself on the streets. He was monitoring the crowd at the conclusion of the day's events. And around 5 p.m. that day, he observed Oath Keeper leader Stuart Rhodes and some other of the Oath Keepers in the crowd. And then he just took a photo of them, and then he emailed immediately from his phone the photo to a group of other agents, and he claimed that he was just doing that for safety and precaution reasons, and that he also claimed that he had first become aware of the Oath Keepers from an article in a magazine called Defense One, or an online magazine called Defense One. Now, one of the defense attorneys, eventually in cross-examination, pointed out that Defense One is a subsidiary, actually, of The Atlantic. And then he also made the additional point that Defense One was a left-leaning, or that The Atlantic, rather, was a left-leaning publication, inferring that their characterization of the Oath Keepers might be a tad skewed. And he gave a couple of examples. Then the prosecution moved on in the questioning of Special Agent McCanley. They began to play a video of Stuart Rhodes calling for Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act, which is a very common theme in this trial from the prosecution. Myself, I'm still trying to wrap my head around, still trying to figure out how this is going to play out, because not only is the Rhodes defense team planning, as announced, to use that as a primary defense in on his behalf, the fact that he was only going to operate in a more, let's say, militaristic way only if Trump had invoked the Insurrection Act. And now I'm beginning to see why they plan that as their defense, because this is the theme coming from the prosecution over and over and over again. They're playing messages, playing videos, playing audio, chat room chats, go-to-meeting chats of Stuart Rhodes talking about the cover of the Insurrection Act, which would cover them legally should they ever need to really step out and get crazy in D.C. for any reason, or to bring their weapons to D.C. We're going to see how all this goes. I don't yet know. Then came, we were anticipating this, but then also with Agent McCannelly on the stand, then came what I call the Rand Paul, or not the Rand Paul, the Ron Paul bomb that everybody was kind of waiting for. And when I say everybody, this was an anticipated thing from libertarian circles, but also from people that hate, from the left, that hate Ron Paul, think that he was some radical extremist. And the reason why that this was important was because, as they revealed, the government revealed in their case, is that Rhodes actually held Capitol building badge, a security badge, which gave him full access to the Capitol building as an aide and also as a legislative correspondent for then Representative Ron Paul. And this was for some months back in late 98 through sometime in 1999. After they revealed that, and the implication being obviously that this was some big thing because Stuart Rhodes knew the layout. He had special knowledge of the layout of the Capitol building, as if there weren't already, you know, 1,000 maps of the Capitol layout online that he could access anytime and that anybody could access at any time. But that was the implication by having this agent talk about and confirm that in his investigation, he had discovered that Oath Keeper founder Stuart Rhodes had at one time had an all-access badge to the Capitol when he worked for Representative Ron Paul. It's one of those nothing burgers, by the way. At this point, it was turned over to the defense for cross-examination, and I was like, that was it? Basically, the final thing that they dealt with from Special Agent McCannelly was the defense was able to get McCannelly to actually admit that the Oath Keepers were doing nothing illegal. And once again, that was the case on November 12th. Then it was turned over, or they brought up the next witness, who was another FBI special agent, Byron Cody. And then the government began to ask him about how he had received certain tips of certain communications, certain inflammatory discussions between the Oath Keepers, obviously mostly led by Stuart Rhodes, that he had received in December of 2020, then even after January 12th in March of 2021. Now asking about the investigation and the statements about Rhodes in November 2020 as well. The first inflammatory statement that Byron Cody presented was a statement by Rhodes when he said, "Time to get serious with training." Now, this was in November of 2020. This was literally a month before the announcement of the January 6th rally even took place. But Rhodes said, "Time to get serious with training. Force on force is the way to go." Then follows a review of more messages that, quite frankly, we're already pretty much familiar with and even had heard from previous testimony. And again, most of which predate the announcement of the January 6th rally. So I'm kind of yawning through that as I'm taking notes on that. Then finally, as Agent Cody's testimony went on, we began seeing, reading, and learning of the legitimacy of these messages. That's basically what they're doing. They're proving the authenticity of these mass messages, of these chats, of these podcasts, of these videos. Again, most of these are led by Stuart Rhodes. But finally, they did get to some that actually took place after the announcement of the January 6th rally, which of course is the more interesting chats, because at that point you have to focus in and realize, all right, now we have to listen to what they were actually planning as their intent of that day. One of the things that they actually read a couple of open letters from Rhodes. One was significantly before the announcement of January 6th, and then another one later. But this is just a couple of, just to give you a flavor and a color of some of the things that Rhodes was saying in these letters and in these chats. Once again, he said, "President Trump, you must be as decisive, if not more so, than Lincoln during the Civil War when he issued an arrest warrant for Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He said, if you fail to do your duty, you will leave you, the people, no choice but to walk in the steps of the founders." The implication is that if Trump didn't do his duty, then the people are going to have to rebel against the government. "We will take arms," he said. "We will fight for our liberty," he said. He's telling Trump, "Keep your promise and drain the swamp. Do it now." This letter was signed by Stuart Rhodes and the Oath Keepers General Counsel, Kelly Sorrell, who was then, just a few weeks ago, also arrested and charged with the conspiracy as well. Following the announcement of the January 6th rally, there's more messages presented that allow the planning, you know, or that show the planning that Rhodes wanted for that day, including who would be leading certain aspects of their operation that day. Mostly just organizational things, and nothing, though, that was indicative of actually attacking the Capitol or any intended violence in those conversations. Finally, the day, as I said, it was a short day. It ended very quickly. Ken Harrelson's attorney, Brad Geyer, he closed out the final cross-examination of the day, establishing that his client, Ken Harrelson, had actually no social media accounts and wasn't added to the DC ops chat even until January 3rd before he was even added. He just wasn't a part of it. And obviously, Geyer wanted to make sure that his guy, Harrelson, was carved out of all these previous conversations that he was not participating in. As a matter of fact, Agent Cody did in fact respond that it was correct that Harrelson was not a part of those early chats and those early planning and those early inflammatory speeches that Rhodes had given in all these different platforms. And then we were done. It was a short day. We were done by about 11:45. The jury was dismissed. They did a little bit more cleanup between the attorneys, you know, some house cleaning issues between open discussions and motions that happen every single day, and that Judge Maeda leaves hanging and says, I'll talk about him later, those kind of things. And so we were done. And then I was invited to go to lunch with some of the defense attorneys. We went a couple blocks around, away from the courthouse to this nice little deli with an outside patio. Sat down, had sandwich with those guys, and then another attorney joined, and he is not an attorney working on this particular case, but he represents several other January 6th clients. His name is Joseph McBride. You've probably seen him on other podcasts and news programs as well. And then at one point, surprisingly, I was sitting right across the outside patio table from McBride, and all of a sudden his face lit up, and he said, hey, and somebody over my right shoulder walks up and they shake hands, and he introduces this gentleman to us, and his name is Alan Fuhrer. Now, I've seen Mr. Fuhrer in the media room, but had no idea who he was. Well, turns out that Alan Fuhrer is in fact the guy. He's the legal correspondent for the New York Times, and especially related to January 6 issues. In fact, he's the guy that wrote the big I called it in my article. I said the New York Times is running cover for Ray Epps. Well, this is the guy that wrote that article. He was also the guy who the previous evening on Thursday night that I had done another podcast, and I mentioned Fuhrer's article in the New York Times because, as I mentioned before, all of the other mainstream media outlets in the room, except for Politico and the New York Times, had completely ignored the freak show prosecution witness, Abdullah Rashid, who was a convicted child molester who was testifying for the prosecution. He was authenticating a recording that he had made of one of their conversations and then had called in as a tip to, he claims, to the FBI, to the Capitol Police, and someone else, but then he couldn't even remember for sure who it was. But I wrote an article about the freak show. You can find that on my locals page. Search freak show. It'll come up. And then the criticism I had of that article as far as Fuhrer's representation of Abdullah Rashad's testimony was, or Rashid's testimony, is the fact that he did mention Rashid, whereas CBS, UPI, AP, Reuters, Huffington Post, I forget who all was in the list that I had in articles that I read, didn't even mention that he was on the stand. I mean, they completely left him out of the story and out of the narrative. Politico was the only one that actually gave a fair accounting of not only the testimony of Rashid, but also his weirdness, but also of the fact that he was a convicted child molester. Whereas Alan Fuhrer from the New York Times did in fact mention Rashid's testimony, but he basically took all of his testimony, cleaned it up, and presented him as a reliable witness on the stand. And that was unfortunately not the case with this witness. And it's why the other MSM branches or other, you know, mouthpieces of the federal government, most certainly are, decided to completely leave him out. They just didn't know what to do with him. His testimony was so bad. It was so conflicted. It was so atrocious. It was so full of holes. It was so contradictory. It was the kind of testimony where he seemed to be in conflict with both the prosecutors and the defense. And not only that, but he opened up the testimony in conflict with the judge himself. As he took the stand, he had his COVID mask on, as are required in the federal courthouse there. But when the judge told him to remove his mask, he just looked at the judge and said, "I don't want to." The judge said, "Well, you're going to have to, and we'll give you a clear mask so that the jury and the courtroom can see your face and when he's responding," which obviously is a very important thing. And rather than wear the clear mask, he decided to go ahead and go maskless. But suffice it to say, as I said before, he was nothing but a freak show. I don't know how in the world he could possibly have done any good for the prosecution other than just the validation of the recording that he had made. But he certainly didn't leave a good impression with the jury and certainly would not have left a good impression with the American public had cameras been in that courtroom. And I would doubt very seriously, because I don't think that that recording was important. There's plenty of other messages. There's plenty of other inflammatory and bravado, you know, God and country and take over the Capitol and Biden is a tool of the Communist Party of China. There's plenty of that other rhetoric from plenty other sources, from Rhodes and other of the Oath Keepers on these particular calls. But I don't think that had cameras been in that courtroom that the prosecution would have dared put him on the stand. But they also knew that they would get covered from the cover from the MSM. And as one of my other journalist friends calls them the palace guard guy, only the right things get out. So that's what took place. So it was an interesting conversation with the New York Times correspondent, Alan Fuhrer, there at the lunch table. And at one point I was gesticulating as I was talking, using my hands, and I was waving my phone around, and he said, "You're not recording this conversation, are you?" And I said, "Oh, no. And I showed him my phone. "No, I'm not recording it." He says, "Yeah, you never know about these independent journalists." And then there was a conversation about Ray Epps. Obviously, he wrote the big, you know, apologetic story for the New York Times about Ray Epps. He was the one that flew out there to the mountains in Colorado or wherever he was and met them where they had escaped from their ranch in Arizona. And he told the attorneys there that I was sitting at the table with, he said, "Forget about Ray Epps. There's nothing there. There's no there there." And the two attorneys, which were Brad Geyer and Joseph McBride, they kind of went at him a little bit, but there was no fight. It was all good, clean fun. And I just got to witness that. So that was an interesting aside for my day, but that took me longer into the afternoon than I had anticipated. That's why I didn't do my day 4 update on Friday, because I had to get back to Raleigh. So I ended up doing that and then had my show Saturday, and recovered on Sunday morning and drove back here last night. So here I am. So before I conclude this thing, let me just kind of give you my overall impression of the first week of the Oath Keepers trial. There, as I said before, there are many, many inflammatory messages and audio recordings of various Oath Keepers at the trial that are being presented in this first week. None of them are flattering. Let's just call a spade a spade. Additionally, here's one additional quote from Stuart Rhodes, and it was a message that he sent out on December 12th of 2020. He says, "We are going to have to fight. That can't be avoided. But it's better to have a fight now while Trump is commander-in-chief than to wait till he is gone." And the reason for that is he really hoped and anticipated that Trump would invoke the Insurrection Act. On 12/14, Rhodes also added, he said, "Trump has one last chance to act. We must use the Insurrection Act unless we fight a bloody civil war and a revolution." So, with that stage set in Stuart Rhodes' rhetoric, why then did not Rhodes call up the entire 35,000 registered members of the Oath Keepers, 35,000 armed Oath Keepers? And then why did he not also conspire with the Proud Boys? And no, there was no conspiracy. There has been no conspiracy presented of of collusion with the Proud Boys whatsoever. Even though the January 6th House committee presentation and hearings tried to imply that, there is no evidence of any conspiracy between the two groups whatsoever. Why didn't Rhodes associate and conspire with the Three Percenters? Why didn't he associate with the Salt and Light Brigade from Ohio? Why didn't he associate the Oath Keepers with all the other various militias, state militias around the country? It doesn't make any sense that he would show up with 12-ish men and women, a couple of them geriatrics, with no arms at all. Because if he would had showed up and had sent out a call for 35,000 Oath Keepers to show up in D.C. on January 6th and bring your guns to take over the Capitol, to stop the vote from being counted, to stop the vote from being certified by Congress, I think the government would have a real case here. Instead, as I said, what we have is we have a dozen-ish individuals now being charged with seditious conspiracy who have never done any violence at any government rally, any rally of any type, certainly not where they've been hired for security services. In fact, I shouldn't even say that. They've never, in the 13-year history of the Oath Keepers, have they ever been arrested for anything. Never have they been charged with a crime for anything. It's just not what they do. It's not who they are, including on January 6th. These are people who did not illegally carry firearms into D.C. that day. They did not breach the Capitol in a military stack, as being implied by every story you see. That's just a flat-out lie. They actually stood on the Capitol steps singing the national anthem while a team of mostly unidentified provocateurs behind them actually forced open the east doors, and then 100 other people entered the Capitol before they ever turned and entered the building themselves. And this was even after hundreds of other individuals had already entered the building from the west side of the building. So the Oath Keepers did not, violently or otherwise, breach the Capitol. That was done before they got there. That was done before they even turned and moved in that direction themselves. So my impression of the prosecution's case thus far in the first week, I can't imagine. I don't think that they probably even realize that they are actually portraying the non-violent activities and the brazen speech of a dozen-ish people as the stupidest humans in the history of the world and expecting the American public to believe that. I mean, if they really expect the American public and the jurors to believe that these dozen-ish peoples, including, as I said before, a couple of geriatrics with loud mouths, believed that they could overthrow the U.S. government, that they could halt the certification of the vote, dismantle our democracy with no guns, and this against two fully armed police forces, the United States Capitol Police, the D.C. Metro Police, as well as tactical units of the FBI, the ATF, U.S. Marshals, as well as embedded Army Special Forces in the crowd. First reported by yours truly back in February of 2021, and then verified in an exclusive Newsweek story in January of 2022. Or maybe the prosecution just doesn't care. Maybe it just doesn't matter to them that the portrayal of these 12-ish individuals taking over the Capitol, taking over the government, thwarting democracy, as is portrayed, with no weapons, is absurd on its face. Maybe they don't care because maybe it's already a fait accompli and they know that they already have the jury in their back pocket. I don't know. Maybe they already know that they're going to get those first five notches in Nancy Pelosi's political narrative gun belt. And make no mistake, this is in fact a political trial. So I'll tell you this in conclusion. The defense attorneys that I've spoken to this past week were actually pretty encouraged by the first week of the trial. And in a just American courtroom, I think that they actually had reason to be. It did not, in a fair courtroom, go well for the prosecution. And that's regardless of what you've heard on the MSM. But we may no longer be living in a just America. And those attorneys may not be arguing their cases before a just Department of Justice and in a just courtroom. And I think that's the important part about this trial, much more far-reaching than just the guilt or innocence of these five individuals. Okay, that's enough for that. Tomorrow I'm back in the courtroom bright and early, and we will be in the middle of week two. So please follow us on our locals community at thepragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com. Also, I am tweet storming every day from the courtroom, and you can do that. Our Twitter page, which is at TPC4USA, at TPC, the number 4USA. So wherever you're following this, please like, share, subscribe. Please go to Rumble and please subscribe. You hear from everybody else, and it's absolutely true. It helps the algorithms. If you're seeing it on Facebook, MeWe, Gab, Parler, True Social, Twitter, Rumble, Locals, like, share, subscribe. Do what you have to do. You guys all know the deal. I don't need to go into that. But I will say also say one more time, they say if you have not because you ask not, I am telling you that we definitely need your support over the next few weeks because expenses are out of hand here in this place. And even though we are sharing an Airbnb, myself and a couple of other people here in D.C., it's stupid expensive to be here. So we can use your help. I can use your help. Thank you very much for that. All right, that's it. Steve, TPC, see you tomorrow.